This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Assassin's Fate, Book 3 of the Fitz and the Fool Trilogy by Robin Hobb. Read for you by Elliot Hill. To Fitz and the Fool, my best friends for over 20 years. Prologue. There are children holding hands in a circle. In the middle, a single child stands. The child wears a blindfold, but there are painted eyes on the blindfold. The eyes are black and staring, edged with red. The child in the middle turns in a circle, hands outstretched. All the other children dance in a wider circle around her. They sing a song. As long as the circle holds, the futures can be foretold. You must be hard of heart to tear the circle apart. It looks like a merry game. Each child in the outer circle shouts a sentence or a phrase. I cannot hear what they are saying, but the blinded child can. She begins to shout back at them, her words torn by a slowly rising wind. Burn it all! The dragons fall! The sea will rise! The jewel-strewn skies! One comes as two! The four shall rue! Two come as one. Your reign is done. Forfeit all lives. No one survives. At that last shout, a gale bursts from the child in the middle. Bits of her fly in all directions, and the wind picks up the screaming children and scatters them far and wide. All becomes black, save for one circle of white. In the center of the circle is the blindfold, with its black eyes staring. Staring. Dream Journal of B. Farcia. Chapter 1. Bee Stings. The map room at Aslevial displayed a territory that included much of the six duchies, part of the mountain kingdom, a large section of Chalced, and lands along both sides of the Rain Wild River. I suspect that it defines for us the boundaries of the ancient Elderlings' territory at the time the maps were created. I have been unable to inspect the map room of the abandoned Elderling city, now known as Kelsingrar, personally, but I believe it would be very similar. On the Aslevial map were marked points that correspond to standing stones within the six duchies. I think it fair to assume that the identical markings in locations in the mountains, Rain Wilds, and even Chalced indicate standing stones that are skill portals. The conditions of those foreign portals are largely unknown, and some skill users caution against attempting to employ them until we have physically journeyed there and witnessed that they are in excellent condition. For the skill portal stones within the six duchies and the mountain kingdom, it seems prudent not only to send skilled couriers to visit every site, but also to require every duke to see that any such standing stones are maintained upright. The couriers who visit each stone should document the content and condition of the runes on each face of the stone as well. In a few instances, we have found standing stones that do not correspond to a marking on the Aslevial map. We do not know if they were raised after the map was created, or if they are stones that no longer function. We must continue to regard them with caution, as we do all use of Elderling magic. We cannot consider ourselves to be masters of it until we can duplicate their artifacts. Skill Portals, Shade Fallstar. I ran. I hiked up the heavy white fur coat I wore, and ran. I was already too warm, and it dragged and snagged on every twig or trunk I passed. Behind me, Dwalia was shouting for someone to, "Catch her! Catch her!" I could hear the Chalcedian making mooing noises. He galloped wildly, once passing so close to me that I had to dodge him. My thoughts raced faster than my feet. I remembered being dragged by my captors into a skill pillar. I even recalled how I had bitten the Chalcedian, hoping to make him release Shun. And he had. But he'd held on to me and followed us into the darkness of the skill pillar. No Shun had I seen, nor that servant who had been last in our chain of folk. Perhaps both she and Shun had been left behind. I hoped Shun would escape her, or perhaps had escaped her. I remembered the cold of a buck winter clutching at us when we fled. But now we were somewhere else, and instead of deep cold, I felt only chill. The snow had retreated into narrow fingers of dirty white in the deeper shade of the trees. The forest smelled of early spring, but no branches had yet leafed out. How did one leap from winter in one place to spring in another? Something was very wrong, but I had no time to consider it. I had a more pressing concern. How did one hide in a leafless forest? I knew I could not outrun them. I had to hide. I hated the coat fiercely. I could not pause to wriggle out the bottom of it, for my hands felt as clumsy as fish flippers, but I could not possibly hide from my pursuers in a huge white fur coat. So I fled, knowing I could not escape, but too frightened to let them reclaim me. Choose a place to take a stand. Not where they can corner you, but not where they can surround you either. Find a weapon, a stick, a rock, anything. If you cannot escape, make them pay as dearly as you can for capturing you. Fight them all the way. Yes, Wolf Father. I spoke his name in my mind to give me courage. I reminded myself that I was the child of a wolf. Even if my teeth and claws were pathetic things, I would fight. But I was already so tired. How could I fight? I could not understand what the passage through the stone had done to me. Why was I so weak and so tired? I wanted to fall where I was and be still. I longed to let sleep claim me, but I dared not. I could hear them calling to one another, shouting and pointing at me. Time to stop running, time to make my stand. I chose my spot, a cluster of three trees, their trunks so close together that I could dodge between them, but none of my pursuers could easily follow me. I could hear at least three people crashing through the bushes behind me. How many might there be? I tried to calm myself enough to think. Dwalia, their leader, the woman who had smiled so warmly as she stole me from my home. She had dragged me through the skill pillar. And Vindalaya, the boy man who could make people forget what they had experienced. He had come through the stone. Kerf was the Chalcedian sellsword, but his mind was so scrambled from our skill journey that either he was no danger to anyone, or he might kill any of us. Who else? Alaria, who would unquestioningly do whatever Dwalia told her, as would Repin, who had so harshly crushed my hand as we came through the pillar. It was a much smaller force than she had started with, but they still outnumbered me 5-1. I crouched behind one of the trees, pulled my arms from the sleeves of the heavy fur robe, and at last wriggled and lifted until I could slide out of it. I picked it up and threw it as far as I could, which was not far. Should I run on? I knew I could not. My stomach was doubling and twisting uneasily, and I had a stitch in my side. This was as far as I could go. A weapon! There was nothing. Only a fallen branch. The thick end was no bigger around than my wrist, and it diverged into three limbs at the other end. A poor weapon. More rake than staff. I took it up. Then I pressed my back to one of the trees, hoping against hope that my pursuers would see the coat and pass me by, so I could double back and find a better hiding spot. They were coming. Dwalia shouted in gasps.
I know you are frightened, but don't run. You will starve and die without us. A bear will eat you. You need us to survive. Come back, Bee. No one will be angry at you.
Then I heard the lie as she turned her fury on her followers.
Oh, where is she? Alaria, you fool, get up!
None of us feels well, but without her, we cannot go home. Then, letting her anger win,
Bee, stop being foolish. Come here, right now. Vindalaya, hurry. If I can run, so can you. Find her. Fog her.
As I stood behind the tree, trying to make my terrified breathing as quiet as I could, I felt Vindalaya reaching for me. I pushed hard to make my thought walls strong, as my father had shown me. I gritted my teeth and bit down on my lip to keep him out. He was making memories of sweet, warm foods and hot soup and fragrant, fresh bread at me. All those things I wanted so much. But if I let him make me think about them, he could find a way in. No. Raw meat. Meat frozen onto bones, gnawing it off with my back teeth. Mice with their fur on and their little crunchy skulls. Wolf food. Wolf food. Strange how delicious it sounded. I gripped my stick with both hands and waited. Should I stay hidden and hope they would run past me, or step out and strike the first blow? I did not get a choice. I saw Alaria go stumbling past my hiding place several trees away. She halted, looked stupidly at the white fur on the ground, and then as she turned to call back to the others, she saw me.
She's here! I found her!
She pointed at me with a shaking hand. I set my feet shoulder-width apart, as if I were going to play at knife-fighting with my father, and waited. She stared at me, and then sank down in a crumpled heap, her own white coat folding around her, and made no effort to rise.
I found her!
She called in a weaker voice. She flapped a limp hand at me. I heard footsteps to my left.
Look out!
Alaria gasped. But she was too late. I swung my branch as hard as I could, connected with Dwalia's face, and then danced back to the right between the trees. I set my back to one trunk and took up my stance again, branch at the ready. Dwalia was shouting, but I refused to look and see if I'd hurt her. Perhaps I'd been lucky enough to put one of her eyes out. But Vindalaya was lumbering toward me, his doltish smile beaming.
Brother! There you are. You are safe. We found you.
Stay back, or I'll hurt you, I threatened him. I found I didn't want to hurt him. He was a tool of my enemy, but left to himself, I doubted he had any malice. Not that a lack of malice would prevent him from hurting me.
Brother,
he said, drawing the word out sadly. It was a rebuke. But a gentle one. I realized he was radiating gentleness and fondness at me. Friendship and comfort. No, he was not truly any of those things. Stay back, I commanded him. The Chalcedian lolloped past us, ululating as he went, and I could not tell if he deliberately or accidentally jostled against the little man. Vindalaya tried to avoid him, but stumbled and fell flat with a mournful cry, just as Dwalia rounded the tree trunks. Her hands were extended toward me like claws, her lips pulled back from her bloodied teeth, as if she would seize me in her jaws. Two-handed, I swung my branch at her, willing it to knock her head from her shoulders. Instead, it broke and the jagged end dragged across her reddened face, trailing a line of blood. She flung herself at me, and I felt her nails dig into my flesh right through my worn clothing. I literally tore myself free of her grip. She kept part of my sleeve as I squeezed between the tree trunks. Repin was waiting there. Her fish-gray eyes met mine. Hatred gave way to a mindless glee as she leapt toward me. I dodged sideways, leaving her to embrace the tree face first. She hit, but she was spryer than I thought. One of her feet hooked mine. I jumped high, cleared it, but stumbled on the uneven ground. Alaria had regained her feet. She wailed wildly as she threw herself against me. Her weight carried me to the ground, and before I could wriggle out, I felt someone step hard on my ankle. I grunted, then cried out as the pressure increased. It felt as if my bones were bending, as if they would snap at any instant. I shoved Alaria off me, but the moment she was clear, Repin kicked me in the side, hard, without getting off my ankle. Her foot slammed all the air out of me. Tears I hated swelled in my eyes. I thrashed for a moment, then wrapped myself around her legs and struggled to get her off my ankle, but she grabbed my hair and shook my head wildly. Hair ripped from my scalp, and I could not focus my vision.
"Beat her!"
I heard Dwalia's voice. It shook with some strong emotion. Anger? Pain?
"With this."
I made the mistake of looking up. Repin's first blow with my broken stick caught my cheek, the hinge of my jaw, and my ear mashing it into the side of my head. I heard a high ringing and my own shriek. I was shocked, outraged, offended, and in a disabling amount of pain. I scrabbled to get away, but she still had a thick handful of my hair. The stick fell again, across my shoulder blades as I struggled to break free. There was not enough meat on my bones, and my blouse was no protection. The pain of the blow was followed by the instant burn of broken skin. I cried out wildly and twisted, reaching up to grip her wrist and try to wrest her hand free of my hair. She put more weight on my ankle, and only the cushion of forest humus kept it from breaking. I shrieked and tried to push her off. The stick fell again, lower on my back, and I suddenly knew how my ribs joined my spine and the twin columns of muscle that ran alongside my spine, for all of it screeched with wrong. It happened so fast, and yet each individual blow was a single event in my life, one to be always remembered. I'd never been treated harshly by my father, and the very few times my mother had disciplined me, it had been little more than a cuff or a light slap. Always to warn me of danger, to caution me not to touch the fire screen or reach over my head for the kettle on the hob. I'd had a few tussles with children at Withywoods. I'd been pelted with pine cones and small stones, and once I'd been in a serious fight that left me bloodied. But I had never been beaten by an adult. I'd never been held in a painful way while a grown-up tried to deliver as much pain as she could, regardless of how it might injure me. I suddenly knew that if she knocked out my teeth or struck an eye from its socket, no one would care except me.
"Stop being afraid. Stop feeling the pain. Fight!"
Wolffather was suddenly with me, his teeth bared and every hackle standing up.
"I can't. Repin is going to kill me."
"Hurt her back. Bite her. Scratch her, kick her, make her pay for giving you pain. She is going to beat you anyway, so take what you can of her flesh. Try to kill her. But fight."
I stopped trying to wrest her grip from my hair. Instead, as my stick fell again on my back, I lunged toward her, caught the wrist of her stick hand, and pulled it to my mouth. I opened my jaws as wide as I could and then closed them. I bit her, not to hurt her, not to leave tooth marks or make her shout with pain. I bit her to drive my teeth down to her bone, to gain a mouthful of flesh and sinew and try to tear it free of her body. I set my teeth as she shrieked and flailed at me with the stick, and then I worried the meat of her wrist, shaking my head fiercely. She let go of my hair, dropped the stick and danced about, yelling in pain and fear, but I kept my grip on her wrist, with both my hands and my teeth, and kicked at her shins and feet and knees as she dragged me about with her. I tried to make my molars meet as I clenched my jaws and hung my weight from her arm. Repin roared and thrashed. She dropped the stick and thought only to pry herself free. She was not a large person. She was slight of build, and I had a good chunk of the stringy meat and flabby muscle of her forearm in my teeth. I worked my jaw together. She was shrieking.
"Get her off me! Get her off me!"
She set the palm of her hand to my forehead and tried to push me away. I let her, and she screamed as she helped me tear meat from her bones. She slapped at me, but weakly. Jaws and hands, I gripped her tighter. She sank to the earth, with me still locked to her arm.
"Beware," Wolffather warned me. "Spring away."
But I was a cub, and I did not see the danger, only that my enemy had collapsed before me. Then Dwalia kicked me so hard that my mouth flew open. It knocked me free of Repin onto the damp earth. With no air in me, all I could do was roll feebly instead of getting to my feet and running away. She kicked me repeatedly, my belly, my back. I saw her booted foot coming toward my face. When I woke up, it was dark and cold. They had managed a fire, but its light barely touched me. I was lying on my side, facing away from the fire, bound hand and foot. My mouth was salty with blood, both thick and fresh. I had wet myself, and the fabric of my trousers was cold against me. I wondered if they had hurt me so badly that I peed, or if I had been that frightened. I could not remember. I woke up crying, or perhaps I realized I was crying after I woke up. Everything hurt. My face was swollen on one side from where Repin had hit me with the stick. My face might have bled, for dead leaves were stuck to my skin. My back hurt, and my ribs caged my painful breaths.
Can you move your fingers? Can you feel your toes?
I could.
Does your belly hurt like a bruise, or does it hurt like things are broken inside?
I don't know. I never hurt like this before. I drew in a deeper breath, and the pain forced it out as a sob.
Hush. Don't make a sound, or they will know you are awake. Can you get your hands to your mouth?
They had tied my feet together and bound my hands at the wrists in front of me. I brought them up to my face. They were tied together with strips torn from my shirt. That was part of why I felt so cold. Although spring had visited here during the day, winter reclaimed this forest at night.
Chew your hands free.
I can't. My lips were smashed and bloody. My teeth felt loose and sore in my gums.
You can, because you must. Chew your hands free and untie your feet, and we will go. I will show you where to go. There is someone kin to us, not far from here. If I can wake him, he will protect you. If not, I will teach you to hunt. Once your father and I lived in these mountains. Perhaps the den he built for us is still tight. We will go there.
I didn't know we were in the mountains. You lived in the mountains with my father?
I did. I have been here before. Enough. Start chewing.
It hurt to bend my neck to reach the bindings on my hands. It hurt to press my teeth in hard enough to bite the fabric. It had been a nice shirt the morning I had put it on to go to my lessons with Scribe Lant. One of the maids, Caution, had helped me dress. She'd chosen this pale yellow blouse, and over it she had tugged a green tunic. The colors of my house, I suddenly realized. She'd dressed me in Withywood's colors, even if the tunic had been too big for me and hung on me like a dress, nearly to my knees. I'd worn leggings that day, not the padded trousers my captors had given me to wear. The wet trousers. Another sob rose in me. Before I could choke it back, I made a sound.
Awake?
Someone asked by the fire. Alaria, I thought.
Leave her as she is,
Dwalia commanded harshly.
But my brother is hurt. I can feel his pain.
This from Vindalaya in a low and woeful voice.
Your brother.
Dwalia's words dripped with venom.
Trust a sexless lout like you not to be able to tell the unexpected son from some white's byblow. All the coin we spent, all the lurex I wasted, and that girl is all we have to show for it. Stupid and ignorant, both of you. You think she's a boy and she doesn't know what she is. She can't even write and pays no attention to her dreams.
A strange gloating filled her voice.
But I know she's special.
Then the fleeting satisfaction was gone, replaced with a sneer.
Doubt me, I don't care. But you'd best hope there's something special about her,
for she's the only coin we have to buy our way back into the Four's good graces. In a lower voice she added, How Coultry will crow over my failure. And that old bitch Capra will use it as an excuse for anything she wants to do. Elaria spoke very softly. So if she is all we have, perhaps we should try to deliver her in good condition?
Perhaps if you had caught her instead of falling to the ground and rolling about moaning, none of this would have happened.
Do you hear that?
A desperate whisper from Repin. Did you hear that? Someone just laughed. And now, do you hear those pipes playing?
Your mind is turned, and all because a little girl bit you. Keep your foolish words to yourself.
I could see the bone. My arm is all swollen. The pain thuds through me like a drum.
There was a pause, and I heard the fires crackling.
Stay still, Wolffather warned me. Learn all you can by listening.
Then, with a touch of pride,
See, even with your poor cow's teeth, you have taught her to fear you. You must teach all of them to fear you. Even the old bitch has learned some caution. But you must drive it deeper. These must be your only three thoughts.
I will escape. I will make them fear me, and if I have the chance, I will kill them.
They have already beaten me just for trying to escape. What will they do if I kill one?
They will beat you again, unless you escape.
But you have heard you have value to them, so they probably will not kill you.
Probably?
Terror swept through me.
I want to live. Even if I live as their captive, I want to live.
You think that is true, but I assure you it is not. Death is better than the sort of captivity they plan for you. I have been a captive, a toy for heartless men. I made them fear me. It is why they sought to sell me. It was why your father could buy my freedom.
I do not know that tale.
It is a dark and sad one.
Thought is fast. So much was conveyed between Wolffather and me in the pause of the pale folk's conversation. Suddenly, a shout came from the darkness. It terrified me, and I made myself chew faster on my bonds. Not that I seemed to be making progress with the task. The garbled words came again, and I recognized Chael-Sedien. It would be Cuff, the Chael-Sedien mercenary Vindelire had bespelled to Dwalia's service. I wondered if his mind was still scattered by his journey through the pillar. I wondered if his hand was swollen where I had bitten him. As silently as I could, I shifted my body until I could peer through the darkness. Kerf was pointing up at one of the ancient standing pillars at the edge of the clearing. I heard a shriek from Repin.
See? See? I am not mad. Kerf sees her as well. A pale ghost crouches upon that pillar. You must see her. Is she not a white, but dressed so strangely, and she sings a mocking song?
I see nothing,
Dwalia shouted angrily. Vindelire spoke timidly.
I do. There are echoes here of folk from long ago. They held a market here, but now as evening closes in, a white singer makes merry for them.
I hear something. Elaria confirmed reluctantly. And as I came through that stone, people spoke to me. They said awful things. She took a little gasping breath. And when I fell asleep this afternoon, I had a dream. A vivid dream, one I must tell. We lost our dream journals when we fled the Chael-Sedians. I cannot write it down, so I must tell it. Dwalia made a disgusted noise.
As if your dreams were ever of any real worth. Tell away, then.
Repin chimed in quickly, as if the words leapt from her. I dreamed of a nut in a wild river. I saw someone pull it from the water. The nut was set down and struck many times to try to break it. but it only got thicker and harder. Then someone crushed it. Flames and darkness and a foul stench and screams came out of it. The flames wrote words. "Comes the destroyer that you have made." And a great wind swept through Clarez and picked us all up and scattered us.
"Comes the destroyer,"
the Chalcedian repeated in a happy shout from the darkness.
"Be silent,"
Dwalia snapped at him, and he laughed.
"And you, Repin, be silent as well. This is not a dream worth sharing. It is nothing but your fever boiling in your mind. You are such cowardly children. You make shadows and phantoms in your own minds. Aleria and Repin, go gather more wood. Make a good stack for the night, and then check on that little bitch. And say not one more word of this nonsense."
I heard Aleria and Repin tramp off into the woods. It seemed to me they went slowly, as if fearful of the darkness. But Kerf paid no attention to them. Hands uplifted, he shuffled in a clumsy dance all around the pillar. Mindful of Vindelire's power, I lowered my walls cautiously. The bee humming I'd been aware of became voices, and I saw elderlings in bright garments. Their eyes sparkled and their hair gleamed like polished silver and golden rings, and all around the Chalcedian they danced to the chanting of the pale songster perched on the pillar. Dwalia stared at Kerf, annoyed at his enjoyment.
"Why can't you control him?"
she demanded of Vindelire. He gestured helplessly.
"He hears too many others here. Their voices are many and strong. They laugh and sing and celebrate."
"I hear nothing."
Dwalia's voice was angry, but there was a thread of fear in it.
"You are useless. You cannot control that bit of a girl, and now you cannot control a madman. I had such hopes for you when I chose you, when I gifted you with that potion. How wrong I was to waste it on you. The others were right. You have no dreams, and you see nothing. You are useless."
I felt a thin chill of Vindelire's awareness waft toward me. His misery lapped against me like a wave. I slammed my walls tight and tried not to care that he was hurt, and yet still worried for me. His fear of Dwalia, I told myself fiercely, was too great for him to offer me any aid or comfort. Of what use is a friend who will take no risks for you?
"He is your enemy just as much as the others are. If an opportunity arises, you must kill him, just as you would any of them. If any of them comes to touch you, you must bite and kick and scratch as much as you are able."
"I hurt all over. I have no strength. If I try to defend myself, they will beat me."
"Even if you do only a little damage, they will learn that touching you has a price. Some will not be willing to pay it."
"I do not think I can bite or kill Vindelire. Dwalia I could kill, but the others..."
"They are her tools, her teeth and claws. In your situation, you cannot afford to be merciful. Keep chewing on your bonds. I will tell you of my days as a captive. Beaten and caged. Forced to fight dogs or boars that were just as miserable as I was. Starved. Open your mind to my tale of how I was enslaved and how your father and I broke the bonds of our captivities. Then you will see why you must kill when you are given the chance."
He began, not a telling, but a remembering that I shared. It was like recalling things I had always known, but in scalding detail. He did not spare me his memories of his family killed, of beatings and starvation and a cramped, cold cage. He did not soften how much he hated his captors, or how he had first hated my father, even when my father freed him. Hate had been his habit then, and hate had fed him and kept him alive when there was nothing else. I was not even halfway through the twisted fabric that bound my wrists when Dwalia sent Alaria to fetch me to the fire. I played dead until she was hunched over me. She put a hand on my shoulder.
"Bee?"
I flipped, lunged, and bit. I caught her hand in my teeth, but only for a moment. My mouth was too sore, and she ripped her hand free of me with a cry and sprang back. "She bit me," she cried to the others. "The little wretch bit me."
"Kick her,"
Dwalia commanded, and Ilaria made a feint at me with her foot. But Wolffather was right. She feared to get too close. I rolled away from her, and, despite the screams of my abused body, managed to sit up. I glared at her from my one good eye and lifted my smashed lips clear of my teeth. I did not know how much of that she could see in the firelight's dance, but she did not come near me. "She's awake," Ilaria informed them, as if I might have bitten her in my sleep.
"Drag her here.
She'll bite me again." Dwalia stood. She moved stiffly. I held still, poised to avoid her kick or to attack with my teeth if I could. I was pleased to see that I had blacked her eyes and split the flesh on one of her cheeks.
"Listen, you little wretch,"
she snarled at me. "You can avoid a beating, but only if you obey me. Is that clear?"
"She bargains. That means she fears you."
I stared at her, wordlessly, letting nothing show on my face. She leaned closer, reaching for the front of my shirt. I bared my teeth soundlessly, and she drew back. She spoke as if I'd agreed to obey her.
"Ilaria is going to cut your ankles free. We'll take you over by the fire. If you try to run, I swear I will cripple you."
She did not wait for a response. "Ilaria, cut the bonds on her ankles." I thrust my feet toward her. Ilaria, I noted, had a very nice belt knife. I wondered if I could find a way to make it mine. She sawed and sawed at the fabric that bound me, and I was surprised at how much it hurt. When finally she cut through, I kicked my feet to free them, and then felt a very unpleasant hot tingling as they came back to life. Was Dwalia tempting me to try to escape to have an excuse to beat me again?
"Not yet. Gather more strength. Appear weaker than you are."
"Get up and walk,"
Dwalia ordered me. She stalked away from me, as if wanting to demonstrate to me how certain she was of my obedience. Let her be certain of my surrender. I'd figure out how to get away from her. But the wolf was right. Not yet. I stood, but very slowly, taking my time to get my balance. I tried to stand straight as if my belly were not full of hot knives. Her kicks had hurt something inside of me. I wondered how long it would take to heal. Vindelire had ventured closer to us.
"Oh, my brother,"
he mooed sadly at the sight of my broken face. I stared at him, and he looked away. I tried to appear defiant rather than hobbled by pain as I stalked toward the fire. It was my first chance to have a good look at my surroundings. The pillar had brought us to an open dell in the heart of a forest. There were dwindling fingers of snow between the trees, but it was inexplicably missing in the plaza and on the roads leading to it and away. Trees had grown large alongside those roads, and their branches arced over it and interlaced in some places. Yet the roads, too, were largely clear of forest debris and snow. Did no one else recognize how peculiar that was? Evergreens with low, swooping branches surrounded the dell where Dwalia's folk had built their fire. No, not a dell. I scuffed my feet against some sort of paving stones. The open area was partially bounded by a low wall of worked stones set with several pillars. I saw something on the ground. It looked like a glove, one that had spent part of the winter under snow. Farther on, I saw a scrap of leather, perhaps from a strap, and then a woolen hat. Despite my aching body, I slowly stooped to pick it up, feigning to take a moment to cradle my belly. Over by the fire, they pretended not to watch me, like cats hunched near a mouse hole. The hat was damp, but even damp wool is warm. I tried to shake the spruce needles from it, but my arms hurt too much. I wondered if anyone had brought my heavy fur coat back to the camp. Now that I was up and moving, the chill of the early spring night reminded me of every aching bruise. The cold reached in and fingered my skin where they had torn strips from my shirt.
"Ignore that,"
Don't think of the cold. Use your other senses. I could see little beyond the reach of the fire's dancing light. I drew breath through my nose. The rising moisture of the earth brought rich scents with it. I smelled dark earth and fallen spruce needles, and honeysuckle. Honeysuckle, at this time of year? Breathe out through your mouth, and slowly in through your nose, Wolffather advised me. I did. I turned my head slowly on my stiff neck, following the scent. There, a pale, slender cylinder, half covered by a scrap of torn canvas. I tried to stoop down, but my knees folded, and I nearly fell on my face. With my bound hands, I awkwardly picked up the candle. It was broken, held together only by the wick. But I knew it. I lifted it to my face and smelled my mother's handiwork. "How can this be here?" I asked the night softly. I looked at the nondescript scrap of canvas. Nearby there was a lady's lace glove, sodden and mildewed. I did not know either of those things, but I knew this candle. Could I be mistaken? Could other hands have harvested the beeswax and scented it with honeysuckle blossoms? Could another hand have patiently dipped the long wicks over and over into the wax pot to form such an elegant taper? No. This was my mother's work. Possibly I had helped to make this candle. How did it come here?
Your father has been here.
Is that possible? It is the least impossible answer that I can imagine. The candle folded in two as I slid it into my shirt. I felt the wax chill against my skin. Mine. I could hear Vindalaya shuffling toward me. From the corner of my eye, I saw Dwalia holding her hands out to the fire's warmth. I turned my good eye toward them. Repin had my big fur coat. She had folded it into a cushion and was sitting on it by the fire next to Alaria. She saw me looking and sneered at me. I stared at her arm and then lifted my eyes to smile at her. Her exposed hand was a fat pad with sausage fingers. Blood was dark between her fingers and in the lines of her knuckles. Had she not had the sense to wash out the bite? I moved slowly to the biggest gap in their circle and sat down there. Dwalia rose and came to stand behind me. I refused to look back at her.
You'll get no food tonight. Don't think you can run away from us. You can't. Alaria, you will take the first watch.
Wake Repin to take the second. Don't let Bee escape, or you'll pay the price. She stalked away to where they had piled the packs and supplies they'd brought with them. There wasn't much. They had fled Elik's attack with whatever they could hastily seize. Dwalia made herself a lumpy cushion from the packs and reclined on them with no thought for the comfort of the others. Repin looked around slyly and then spread out my opened coat before lying down on it and wrapping the excess around herself. Vindalaya stared at them and then simply flopped down like a dog. He pillowed his broad head on his arms and stared dolefully at the fire. Alaria sat cross-legged, glaring at me. No one paid any attention to the Chalcedian. Hands over his head, he was dancing a sort of a jig in a circle, his mouth wide in mindless enjoyment of the ghost music. His brain might have been dazed, but he was an excellent dancer. I wondered where my father was. Did he think of me? Had Shun gone back to Withywoods to tell him that I'd been taken into a stone? Or had she died in the forest? If she had, he would never know what had become of me or where to look. I was cold and very hungry, and so lost.
If you can't eat, sleep. Rest is the only thing you can give yourself right now. Take it.
I looked at the hat I'd salvaged, plain grey wool, undyed, but well spun and knitted. I shook it to be sure there were no insects in it, and then, with my hands still tied, struggled to get it onto my head. The damp was chill but slowly warmed from my skin. I maneuvered myself into a reclining position on my less painful side and faced away from the fire. The warmth of my body had woken the candle's scent. I breathed honeysuckle. I curled slightly, as if I was seeking sleep, but brought my wrists up to my face and began again to chew at my bonds.
Chapter 2. The Silver Touch. There is a peculiar strength that comes to one who is facing the final battle. That battle is not limited to war, nor the strength to warriors. I have seen this strength in old women with the coughing sickness, and heard of it in families that are starving together. It drives one to go on, past hope or despair, past blood loss and gut wounds, past death itself in a final surge to save something that is cherished. It is courage without hope. During the Red Ship Wars, I saw a man with blood gouting in spurts from where his left arm had once been, yet swinging a sword with his right as he stood, protecting a fallen comrade. During one encounter with Forged Ones, I saw a mother stumbling over her own entrails as she shrieked and clutched at a forged man, trying to hold him away from her daughter. The Out-Islanders have a word for that courage. Finbleed, they call it. The last blood, and they believe that a special fortitude resides in the final blood that remains in any person before they fall. According to tales, only then can one find and use that sort of courage. It is a terrible bravery, and at its strongest and worst, it goes on for months when one battles a final illness. Or, I believe, when one moves toward a duty that will result in death, but is completely unavoidable. That Finbleed lights everything in one's life with a terrible radiance. All relationships are illuminated for what they are and for what they truly were in the past. All illusions melt away. The false is revealed as starkly as the true. Fitzchivalry Farseer. As the taste of the herb spread in my mouth, the sounds of the turmoil around me grew louder. I lifted my head and tried to focus my stinging eyes. I hung in Lance's arms, the familiar bitterness of elf bark suffusing my mouth. As the herb damped my magic, I became more aware of my surroundings. My left wrist ached with a bone-deep pain, as searing as frozen iron. While the skill had surged through me, healing and changing the children of Kelsingrar, my perception had shrunk, but now I was fully aware of the shouting of the crowd surrounding me as the sound bounced from the lofty walls of the elegant elderling chamber. I smelled fear sweat in the air. I was caught in the press of the mob, with some elderlings fighting to step away from me as others were shoving to get closer in the hope I might heal them. So many people, hands reached toward me with cries of, "Please, please, just one more." Others shouted, "Let me through!" as they pushed to get away from me. The skill current that had flowed so strongly around me and through me had abated, but it wasn't gone. Lance Elfbark was the milder herb, 6 duchies grown and somewhat stale by the taste of it. Here in the Elderling City, the skill flowed so strong and close, I did not think even Delvenbark could have closed me to it completely. But it was enough. I was aware of the skill, but no longer shackled to its service. Yet the exhaustion of letting it use me now slackened my muscles just when I had most need of them. General Rapscal had torn the fool from my grasp. The elderling gripped Amber's wrist and held her silvered hand aloft, shouting,
"I told you so! I told you they were thieves! Look at her hand, coated in the dragon's silver! She has discovered the well. She has stolen from our dragons."
Spark clung to Amber's other arm, trying to drag her free of the general's grip. The girl's teeth were bared, her black curls wild around her face. The look of sheer terror on Amber's scarred face both paralyzed and panicked me. The years of privation the fool had endured were betrayed in that stark grimace. They made her face a death mask of bones and red lips and rouged cheeks. I had to go to the fool's aid, and yet my knees kept folding of their own accord. Perseverance seized my arm.
Prince Fitz Chivalry, what must I do?
I could not find the breath to reply to him.
Fitz, stand up!
Lant roared right next to my ear. It was as much plea as command. I found my feet and pressed my weight against them. I strained, shuddering, trying to keep my legs straight under me. We had arrived in Kelsingrad just the day before, and for a few hours I had been the hero of the day, the magical Six Duchies prince who had healed Efron, the son of the king and queen of Kelsingrad. The skill had flowed through me, as intoxicating as Sand's Edge brandy. At the request of King Rain and Queen Malta, I had used my magic to set right half a dozen dragon-touched children. I had opened myself to the powerful skill current of the old Elderling City. Awash in that heady power, I'd opened throats and steadied heartbeats, straightened bones and cleared scales from eyes. Some I'd made more human, though one girl had wished to embrace her dragon changes, and I'd helped her do that. But the skill flow had become too strong, too intoxicating. I'd lost control of the magic, become its tool instead of its master. After the children I'd agreed to heal had been claimed by their parents, others had pushed forward. Adult Rainwilders, with changes uncomfortable, ugly, or life-threatening, had begged my aid, and I had dispensed it with a lavish hand, caught in the vast pleasure of that flow. I'd felt my last shred of control give way, but when I'd surrendered to that glorious surge and its invitation to merge with the magic, Amber had stripped the glove from her hand. To save me, she'd revealed the stolen dragon silver on her fingers. To save me, she'd pressed three scalding fingertips to my bare wrist, burned her way into my mind, and called me back. To save me, she'd betrayed herself as a thief. The hot kiss of her fingers' touch still pulsed like a fresh burn, sending a deep ache up the bones of my left arm, to my shoulder, to my back and neck. What damage it was doing to me now, I could not know. But at least I was again anchored to my body. I was anchored to it, and it was dragging me down. I'd lost track of how many elderlings I'd touched and changed. But my body had kept count. Each one had taken a toll from me. Each shaping had torn strength from me, and now that debt had to be paid. Despite all my efforts, my head lolled, and I could scarcely keep my eyes open amid the danger and noise all around me. I saw the room as through a mist.
Rapscal, stop being an imbecile!
That was King Rain adding his roar to the din. Lant abruptly tightened his hug around my chest, dragging me more upright.
Let her go! He bellowed. Release our friend, or the prince will undo every cure he has worked. Let her go right now!
I heard gasps, wailing, a man shouting,
No! He must not!
A woman screamed,
Let go of her, Rapscal! Let her go!
Malta's voice rang with command as she cried out,
This is not how we treat guests and ambassadors. Release her, Rapscal, this moment.
Her cheeks were flushed, and the crest of flesh above her brow bloomed with color.
Let go of me.
Amber's voice rang with authority. From some deep well of courage, she had drawn the will to fight back on her own behalf. Her shout cut through the crowd's noise.
Release me! Or I will touch you.
She made good her threat, surging toward Rapscal instead of trying to pull her hand free. The sudden reverse shocked him, and her silvered fingers came perilously close to his face. The general gave a shout of alarm and sprang back from her as he let go of her wrist. But she was not finished.
Back, all of you,
she commanded.
Give us room and let me see to the prince, or by Saar I will touch you.
Hers was the command of an angered queen, pitched to carry her threat. Her silvered forefinger pointed as she swung it in a slow arc, and people were suddenly stumbling over one another in their haste to be out of her reach.
The mother of the girl with dragon feet spoke.
I do as she says,
she warned.
If that is truly dragon silver on her fingers, one touch of it will mean slow death. It will seep down to your bones, right through your flesh. It will travel your bones, up your spine to your skull. Eventually you will be grateful to die from it.
As others were falling back from us, she began pushing her way through the crowd toward us. She was not a large person, but the other dragon keepers were giving way to her. She stopped a safe distance from us. Her dragon had patterned her in blue and black and silver. The wings that weighted her shoulders were folded snug to her back. The claws on her toes tapped the floor as she walked. Of all the elderlings present, she was most heavily modified by her dragon's touch. Her warning and Amber's threat cleared a small space around us. Amber retreated to my side, gasping as she sought to calm her breath. Spark stood on her other side, and Perseverance took up a position in front of her. Amber's voice was low and calm as she said,
Spark, retrieve my glove, if you would.
Of course, my lady.
The requested item had fallen to the floor. Spark stooped and cautiously picked it up in two fingers.
I will touch your wrist,
she warned Amber and tapped the back of her hand to guide it to her glove. Amber was still breathing unsteadily as she gloved her hand. But weak as I was horribly glad to see that she had regained some of the fool's strength and presence of mind. She linked her unsilvered hand through my arm, and I was reassured by her touch. It seemed to draw off some of the skill current still coursing through me. I felt both connected to her and less battered by the skill.
I think I can stand, I muttered to Lant, and he loosened his grip on me. I could not allow anyone to see how drained I was of strength. I rubbed my eyes and wiped elf bark powder from my face. My knees did not buckle, and I managed to hold my head steady. I straightened up. I badly wanted the knife in my boot, but if I stooped for it, I knew I would not stop until I sprawled on the floor. The woman who had warned the others stepped into the empty space that now surrounded us, but stayed beyond arm's reach.
Lady Amber, is it truly dragon silver on your hand?
She asked in quiet dread.
It is.
General Rapskull had found his courage and took up a stance beside her.
And she has stolen it from the dragon's well. She must be punished. Keepers and folk of Kelsingrar, we cannot be seduced by the healing of a few children. We do not even know if this magic will last or if it is a cheat. But we have all seen the evidence of this intruder's theft, and we know that our first duty is and must always be to the dragons who have befriended us.
Speak for yourself, Rapskull.
The woman gave him a cold stare.
My first duty is to my daughter, and she no longer totters when she stands.
Are you so easily bought, Timara?
Rapskull demanded scathingly. The father of the child stepped into the circle to stand beside the woman called Timara. The girl with the dragon feet rode on his shoulder and looked down on us. He spoke as if he scolded a willful child, rebuke tinged with familiarity.
Of all people, Rapskull, you should know that Timara cannot be bought. Answer me this. Who has it harmed that this lady has silvered her fingers? Only herself. She will die of it. So what worse can we do to her? Let her go. Let all of them go, and let them go with my thanks.
She stole!
Rapskull's shout turned to a shriek, his dignity flung to the wind. Rain had managed to elbow his way through the crowd. Queen Malta was right behind him, her cheeks pink beneath her scaling and her eyes fiery with her anger. The dragon changes in her were amplified by her fury. There was a glitter in her eyes that was not human, and the crest of flesh in the parting of her hair seemed taller. It reminded me of a rooster's comb. She was the first to speak. My apologies, Prince Fitzchivalry. Lady Amber, our people forgot themselves in their hope of being healed, and General Rapscowl is sometimes—
Don't speak for me,
the general interrupted her.
She stole silver. We saw the evidence, and no, it's not enough that she has poisoned herself. We cannot let her leave Kelsingra. None of them can leave, for now they know the secret of the dragons well.
Amber spoke. She sounded calm, but she pushed her words so that all could hear.
There was silver on my fingers before you were born, I believe, General Rapscowl. Before your dragons hatched, before Kelsingra was found and reclaimed, I bore what we of the Six Duchies call skill on my fingers, and your queen can attest to that.
She is not our queen, and he is not our king.
General Rapscowl's chest heaved with his emotion. Along his neck, patches of his scales showed a bright scarlet.
So they have said over and over. They have said that we must rule ourselves, that they are but figureheads for the rest of the world. So, keepers, let us rule ourselves. Let us put our dragons first, as we are meant to.
He shook a finger at Lady Amber from a safe distance as he demanded of his fellows,
Recall how difficult it was for us to find and renew the Well of Silver. Will you believe her ridiculous tale that she has carried it on her fingertips for scores of years and not died of it?
Queen Malta's rueful voice cut through Rapscowl's rant.
I am sorry to say that I cannot attest to such a thing, Lady Amber. I knew you only briefly during your time in Bingtown, and met you seldom during the negotiations of your loans to many of the traders.
She shook her head.
A trader's word is all she has to give, and I will not bend mine, even to help a friend. The best I can say is that when I knew you in those days, you always went gloved. I never saw your hands.
You heard her!
Rapscowl's shout was triumphant.
There is no proof. There can be no...
If I may speak...
For years, as King Shrewd's jester, the fool had had to make even his whispered comments heard across a large and sometimes crowded room. He had trained his voice to carry, and it now cut through not only Rapscowl's shout, but the muttering of the crowd as well. A simmering silence filled the room. He did not move like a blind man as he stepped into the space his threat had cleared. He was a performer, stepping onto his stage. It was in the sudden grace of his movements and his storyteller's voice and the sweep of his gloved hand. He was the fool to me, and the layer of amber but a part of his performance.
Recall a summer day, dear Queen Malta. You were but a girl, and all was in turmoil in your life. All your family's hopes for financial survival depended on the successful launch of the Paragon, a live ship so insane that thrice he had capsized and killed all his crew. But the mad ship was your only hope, and into his salvage and refitting the Vestrid family had poured the last of their resources.
He had them, and me. I was as caught up in this tale as any of them.
Your family hoped that the Paragon would be able to find and restore to you your father and your brother, both missing for so long, that somehow you could reclaim the Vivacia, your family's own lifeship, for it was rumored that she had been taken by pirates, and not any pirates, but the fabled Captain Kennet himself. You stood on the deck of the mad ship, putting on such a brave face in your made-over gown with last year's parasol. When all the others went below to tour the ship,
You stayed on the deck and I stayed near you, to watch over you, as your Aunt Althea had requested.
I remember that day,
Malta said slowly.
It was the first time we had really spoken to each other. I remember we talked of the future, of what it might hold for me. You told me that a small life would never satisfy me. You told me that I must earn my future. How did you put it?
Lady Amber smiled, pleased that this queen remembered words spoken to her when she was a child.
What I told you is as true today as it was then. Tomorrow owes you the sum of your yesterdays. No more than that, and no less.
Malta's smile was like sunlight.
And you warned me that sometimes people wish that tomorrow did not pay them off so completely.
I did.
The queen stepped forward, unwittingly becoming part of the performance, as she took her place on Amber's stage. Her brow furrowed, and she spoke like a woman in a dream.
And then Paragon whispered to me, and I felt, oh, I did not know it then. I felt the dragon Tintaglia seize my thoughts. I felt she would smother me as she forced me to share her confinement in her tomb. I fainted. It was terrible. I felt I was trapped with the dragon and could never find my way back to my own body.
I caught you, Amber said, and I touched you on the back of your neck with my skilled fingers. Silvered, you would say, and by that magic I called you back to your own body. But it left a mark on you, and a tiny tendril of a link that we share to this very day.
What?
Malta was incredulous.
It's true.
The words burst from King Rain, along with a laugh born of both relief and joy.
On the back of your neck, my dear. I saw it there in the days when your hair was as black as a crow's wing, before Tintaglia turned it to gold. Three greyish ovals, like silver fingerprints, gone dusty with age.
Malta's mouth hung open in surprise. At his words, her hand had darted to the back of her neck, beneath the fall of glorious golden hair that was not blonde.
There was always a tender place there, like a bruise that never healed.
Abruptly, she lifted her cascading locks and held them on top of her head.
Come and look, any that wish. Come and see if what my husband and Lady Amber say is true.
I was one of those who did. I staggered forward, still leaning on Lant, to see the same marks I had once borne on my wrist. Three greyish ovals, the mark of the fool's silvered hand. They were there. The woman called Tamara stared in consternation when it was her turn to see the nape of the queen's neck.
It's a wonder it did not kill you, she said in a hushed voice.
I thought that would be an end of the matter, but when General Rapscal had taken three times as long to stare at the marks as any had, he turned away from the queen and said,
What does it matter if she had the silver then? What does it matter if she stole it a few nights ago, or several decades ago? Silver from the well belongs to the dragons. She must still be punished.
I stiffened my back and tightened my belly. My voice must not shake. A deeper breath to make my words carry. I hoped I would not vomit. It didn't come from a well. It came from King Verity's own hands, which he covered in skill to work his great and final magic. He got it from where a river of skill ran within a river of water. Name it not Dragon Silver. It is skill from the Skill River.
And where might that be?
Rapscal demanded in a voice so hungry it alarmed me. I don't know. I replied honestly. I saw it but once in a skill dream. My king never allowed me to go there with him, lest I give way to the temptation to plunge myself into it.
Temptation?
Timara was shocked. I, who am privileged to use silver to do works for the city, feel no temptation to plunge myself into it. Indeed, I fear it.
That is because you were not born with it coursing in your blood,
the fool said.
As some farseers are, as Prince Fitzchivalry was, born with the skill as a magic within him, one that he can use to shape children, as some might shape stone.
That struck them done.
Is it possible?
This from the winged elderling, a genuine question. Amber lifted her voice again.
The magic I bear on my hands is the same that was accidentally gifted to me by King Verity. It is rightfully mine, not stolen, any more than the magic that courses through the prince's veins. The magic you joyfully allowed him to share with your children. Not stolen any more than the magic within you that changes you and marks your children. What do you call it? Marked by the rain wilds? Changed by the dragons? If this silver on my fingers is stolen, why, then any here who have been healed have shared in the prince's thievery.
That does not excuse, Rapscal began.
Enough of this,
King Rain commanded. I saw Rapscal's eyes flash anger, but he did not speak as Rain added,
We have abused and exhausted our guests. What the prince freely shared, we have demanded in too great a quantity from him. See how pale he is and how he shakes. Please, my guests, return to your chambers. Let us bring you both refreshments and our sincere apologies. But in the greatest quantity of all, let us offer you our thanks.
He advanced, and with a gesture moved Perseverance aside. Behind him came Queen Malta, offering her arm fearlessly to Amber. Rain gripped my upper arm with surprising strength. I found myself a bit humiliated, but thankful for the help. I managed to look back once to see Malta and Spark escorting Amber, while Purr came last of all, slowly and with many a backward glance, as if wary that danger followed us. But the doors closed behind us, without incident. We walked through a corridor lined with curious folk who had been excluded from that audience. Then behind us, I heard the doors open and a gust of conversation belled out to become a roar. The hall seemed interminable. The stairs, when we came to them, wavered in my vision. I could not imagine that I could climb them, but I knew I must. And I did, step by slow step, until we stood outside the doors of my guest chamber.
Thank you,
I managed to say.
You thank me?
Rain gave a snort of laughter.
I would better deserve a curse from you, after what we have put you through.
Not you.
I will leave you in peace,
he said, excusing himself, and remained outside with his queen as my small party entered my room. When I heard Perseverance close the door behind me, relief swept through me, and my knees tried to fold. Lant put his arm around me to help me to the table. I took his hand to steady myself. A mistake. He cried out suddenly and went to his knees. In the same moment, I felt the skill course through me, as swift as a snake striking. Lant clutched at the scar from the sword wound the Chalcedian raiders had given him. It had been closed, apparently healed, but in that brief touch I had known there was more for his body to do, and known, too, of one rib healed crookedly, and a fracture in his jaw that was mildly infected, and giving him pain still. All repaired and set right, if one can call such a harsh correction a repair. I collapsed merrily on top of him. Lant groaned under me. I tried to roll off him, but could not summon the strength. I heard Perseverance gasp,
Oh, sir, let me help you.
Don't touch, I began, but he had already stooped and taken my hand. His outcry was sharper, a young man's voice taken back to a boy's shrill one. He fell onto his side and sobbed twice before he could master the pain. I managed to roll away from both of them. Lant didn't move.
What has happened?
Amber's question was close to a scream.
Are we attacked? Fitz? Fitz, where are you?
I'm here. There's no danger to you. The skill. I touched Lant and Purr. Those were all the words I could manage.
What?
He did. The skill did something to my wound. It's bleeding again. My shoulder.
Perseverance said in a tight voice. I knew it would. It had to. But only briefly. It was hard to find the strength to speak. I lay on my back, staring up at the high ceiling. It mimicked a sky. Artfully crafted fluffy clouds moved across a pale blue expanse. I lifted my head and summoned my voice. It's not blood, Purr. It's just wet. There was still a piece of fabric caught deep in the wound and slowly festering there. It had to come out and the fluids of infection with it. So it did, and your wound closed behind it. It's healed now. Then I lay back on the floor and watched the elegant room swing around me. If I closed my eyes, it went faster. If I opened them, the forested walls wavered. I heard Lant roll over on his belly and then stagger upright. He crouched over Purr and said gently, "Let's look at it." "Look at your injuries as well," I said dully. I shifted my eyes, saw Spark standing over me and cried out, "No! Don't touch me. I can't control it."
"Let me help him,"
Lady Amber said quietly. Two hesitant steps brought her to where I lay on the floor. I pulled my arms in tight, hiding my bare hands under my vest. "No, you of all people must not touch me." She had crouched gracefully beside me, but as he hunkered back on his heels, he was my fool and not Amber at all. There was immense sorrow in his voice as he said,
"Did you think I would take from you the healing that you did not wish to give me, Fitz?"
The room was spinning, and I was too exhausted to hold anything back from him. "If you touch me, I fear the skill will rip through me like a sword through flesh. If it can, it will give you back your sight, regardless of the cost to me, and I believe the cost of restoring your sight will be that I will lose mine." The change in his face was startling. Pale as he was, he went whiter until he might have been carved from ice. Emotion tautened the skin of his face, revealing the bones that framed his visage. Scars that had faded stood out like cracks in fine pottery. I tried to focus my gaze on him, but he seemed to move with the room. I felt so nauseous and so weak, and I hated the secret I had to share with him. But there was no hiding it any longer. "Fool, we are too close. For every hurt I removed from your flesh, my body assumed the wound. Not as virulently as the injuries you carried, but when I healed my knife stabs in your belly, I felt them in mine the next day. When I closed the sores in your back, they opened in mine."
"I saw those wounds,"
Perseverance gasped.
"I thought you'd been attacked, stabbed in the back."
I did not pause for his words. "When I healed the bones around your eye sockets, mine swelled and blackened the next day. If you touch me, fool—"
"I won't,"
he exclaimed. He shot to his feet and staggered blindly away from me.
"Get out of here, all three of you. Leave now. Fitz and I must speak privately. No, Spark. I will be fine. I can tend myself. Please go. Now."
They retreated, but not swiftly. They went in a bunch with many backward glances. Spark had taken Purr's hand, and when they looked back it was with the faces of woeful children. Lant went last, and his expression was set in a farseer stare so like his father's that no one could have mistaken his bloodlines. "My chamber," he said to them as he shut the door behind them, and I knew he would try to keep them safe. I hoped there was no real danger, but I also feared that General Rapskull was not finished with us.
Explain,
the fool said flatly.
I gathered myself up from the floor. It was far harder than it should have been. I rolled to my belly, drew my knees up under me until I was on all fours, and then staggered upright. I caught myself on the table's edge and moved around it until I could reach a chair. My inadvertent healing of first Lantan, then Purr, had extracted the last of my strength. Seated, I dragged in a breath. It was so difficult to keep my head upright. I can't explain what I don't understand. It's never happened with any other skill healing I've witnessed. Only between you and me. Whatever injury I take from you appears on me. He stood, his arms crossed on his chest. He wore his own face, and Amber's painted lips and rouged cheeks looked peculiar now. His eyes seemed to bore into me.
No, explain why you hid this from me. Why you couldn't trust me with the simple truth. What did you imagine? That I would demand you blind yourself that I might see?
I know. I braced my elbows on the table and rested my head in my hands. I could not recall when I had felt more drained. A steady pulse of pounding pain in my temples